Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Topley speaking to you from Washington, D.C., and it's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Good Friday, the 3rd of April, 2015. So this is our Easter and Easter week edition. Now let's start from a relatively promising development, and let us always remember that the essence of the Easter holiday is world peace, right? This is the political import of the holiday, as I've always seen it. So world peace, where do we stand on this? Well, we have the Lausanne Accords approved this week. And with these accords, this preliminary agreement, this framework, whatever it may be called, we have taken an important step towards the pacification of the Middle East. And this is a huge issue, which certainly gives us these cautious reasons for optimism. Now, we don't need to go too much into the technical details, right? The goal of this from the imperialist point of view is to prevent Iran from developing the full nuclear fuel cycle, to attempt to interfere with that, to delay it, and so forth. And remember, anybody who talks about the capability of building a nuclear weapon, if you're trying to deny somebody that capability, then you're essentially saying you will remain backward, underdeveloped, poor, wretched, miserable forever. And that is just not a decent position. It's an absolutely untenable position from the point of view of the progress of human civilization. Now, if you want to say we're going to prevent you from getting a bomb, well, that, I guess, is slightly different. But remember, the nuclear proliferation, the cat is already out of the bag, the genie is out of the bottle. The Israelis, of course, have about 500-plus nuclear weapons. They have a nuclear missile submarine, or two of them. They have a second strike deterrent. They have all this stuff, and they wish to deny this to Iran. So, of course, there is an element of double standards, hypocrisy, and all the rest. But what we now have is this agreement that the Iranians will, for example, limit the number of centrifuges they have operating. They'll cut that by a third. They'll stop enrichment in the Fordow hardened underground nuclear facility. They will, among other things, dismantle or partially dismantle the heavy water reactor that they had been using as a research reactor to acquire a stock of plutonium, and similar things, so that they'll also submit themselves to a robust inspection regime. According to some accounts, the inspection regime is more vigorous than the one accepted by the United States and the Soviet Union back in the 1980s for the strategic arms reduction talks, the START, as well as for the other disarmament treaties of the late Cold War, such as the treaty to limit medium-range and shorter-range nuclear forces in Europe. So the only question I would have about this is whether this goes even too far. It is certainly the case that any honest observer who had been watching these talks, and that's again the P5 plus one and the European Union on one side and Iran on the other. So it's China, Russia, United Kingdom, France, United States, Federal Republic of Germany, and European Union, and Iran on the other side. So they're going to limit enrichment. I don't think they have crossed any fatal lines. In other words, they have not, the Iranians have not compromised the inherent absolute right of the of Iran and everybody else to have the peaceful uses, atoms for peace, peaceful uses of nuclear energy. We'll have to see this as it comes out. And remember, we have had Mogherini of the European Union read out the accord at Lausanne University on Thursday, yesterday. And we've also got this fact sheet, right? It's called, it's the State Department summary of the Lausanne Joint Comprehensive Plan for Action regarding the Islamic Republic of Iran's nuclear program. Now, the Iranians already say that this is not accurate and represents spin, but it is certainly a very promising step. Actually, the one public statement of participant that I think gets closest to the essence is, ironically, German Foreign Minister Steinmeier, who says this is a big decisive step forward. However, the framework agreement has overcome obstacles that had stood in the way of a deal for a decade. And Steinmeier goes on, if a final agreement is achieved, it could, in my view, not only pave the way for a solution to the Iran conflict, but it would be the first and only conflict in the Middle East where we will have achieved a de-escalation. It could therefore provide hope for easing tensions in the region and between Iran and the Arab states. And that's also the Russian view. Russian Foreign Ministry says the deal can help the security situation in the Middle East, in part because Tehran can now participate more actively in efforts to solve conflicts. Now, inside the P5 plus 1 plus EU negotiating group, the most intransigent, the most intractable and truculent was Fabius, French Foreign Minister. Netanyahu had signaled to him, hey, Fabius, I agree with you more than anybody. So Fabius has been, I think, grudgingly forced to swallow the agreement. Hollande, the same thing. He says France is going to be watchful to make sure Iran does not have access to nuclear arms. Even the British, well, of course, Philip Hammond, the British Foreign Secretary, is going to say, this is more than we thought possible 18 months ago and a good basis for what could be a very good deal. Now, he's got to, of course, Hammond has got to say something good because he's facing an election now in about 33 days. Now, one of the things with the deal that is notable, it goes on longer than was thought. Certain features of this, there are a couple of features of this deal that last for 10 years. There are more features that last for 15 years. There are other parts of the deal that go on for 25 years, and some of them are eternal. They are indefinite. They just go on and on and on. Now, what does this mean? One of the objections of the reactionary Republicans, right, the warmongers, that party of warmongers, bigots, speculators, stoners, and reactionaries, is that they want to have the ability to shake up the world from time to time by pulling the chain on this Iran issue. If this deal goes through, if this reaches ratification in 3 months at the end of June with the technical details, the Republicans will have lost this lever for their own demagogic success by threatening the peace of the world. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Topley reporting from Washington, D.C. In order to keep up with all of this, go to Topley.net, Topley.net. And the Tax Wall Street Party has now launched, as of several weeks ago, a daily briefing. In other words, a short communication for guidance in political activity, what's the main thing going on, what you should do. If you want to be world historical, if you want to make a difference, if you want to be effective, get that morning briefing. And one way to get it is to become a member of the Tax Wall Street Party. Go to the appropriate websites and you'll see it. But I contribute as much as I can to this morning briefing of the Tax Wall Street Party, the United Front Against Austerity. And the current one, the one for today, is support the Lausanne Nuclear Accord as an important step towards war avoidance and hit those isolated warmongers hard. Because right now what you've got is the American Republican Party, Netanyahu and his Likudniks, and Saudi. You've got the Dark Ages monarchies of the Persian Gulf, Arabian Gulf, the Gulf. And against them, the world. Once again, we said it, right? United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany, China, Russia, European Union, half the world right there. What is it that Netanyahu thinks he knows that Russia doesn't know? Russia is closer to Iran than he is. What is the point of this? And of course, from the American point of view, we absolutely reject anybody's attempt to drag the United States into a catastrophic war over this issue, which now is susceptible to being solved. So Iran retains the right to enrich uranium for power reactor and research reactor purposes. Iran pledges not to enrich any uranium up to the level required for nuclear weapons. Enrichment at the Four Dow hardened underground site will be suspended. Enrichment will be limited to Natanz, and the Arak heavy water reactor will stop producing plutonium. Intrusive inspections up and down the line. Centrifuges go from 19,000 to a little over 6,000. Some of these will be stored under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is, of course, a UN agency. Now, the pacification of the Middle East now becomes something at least of hypothetical possibility. So we have to push forward. Clearly, what we're going to have here in the United States is a prolonged battle. If you want to look at historical precedents, I would compare it to the battle over the Treaty of Versailles, the ratification of the Treaty of Versailles, proposed by Woodrow Wilson and eventually rejected by the U.S. Senate because of the League of Nations provision. Now, I'm not making any comparison about the merits or the contents, just that this will now be a big event with the American people, perhaps, finally, yet already coming forward to say something about their own future. Do you want catastrophic war? Well, if you don't, you better get busy. It's time to smash these reactionary Republican warmongers who think that they're going to feather their own demagogic political nests by sending your children yet again into some meat grinder in the Middle East. No, no, no. The American people are sick of war. And again, it's the Republicans, the Likudniks, and the Saudis. That's quite a group. Against the world. So, the subsidiary point is that this whole sanctions business. I remember I walked into the Russia Today studio here, and it was April 1st. I think it was 2010. And they said, oh, Russia has agreed to vote sanctions against Iran. And I said, that must be an April Fool joke. Well, this was the Medvedev era, so not so good. And it was not an April Fool joke. But I would say right now, after the farnetications and antics and posturing of the U.S. Senate, this sanctions regime would collapse. In other words, if the U.S. does not approve this, that sanctions regime will collapse for whatever that's worth. Russia, China, and even some European countries will say, to hell with you. You, U.S., did not bargain in good faith. You have let these Republican lunatics run wild. Tom Cotton, the new Metternich. Bob Corker, the new Talleyrand, right? The great diplomats of the 19th century, born again in the form of these Republican lunatics and warmongers. So this will be a big political issue. It will be a political issue in the 2016 elections. The American people are sick of war. And anybody who gets in the way of that, I hope, will pay a terrible political price. They should be sent to Limoges, as the word used to be in France, right? You should be sent out to retirement village, out to pasture. If you don't support this deal, then you are on the wrong side of history. The other one is, what's the comparison in terms of contents and the positive effect? It is the limited nuclear test ban treaty of August 1963. You remember that Kennedy, rightly shocked by how close the world was to ultimate destruction in the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962, Kennedy then came out with the limited nuclear test ban treaty. He ordered the State Department, including Averell Harriman. Averell Harriman, a satanic individual in my book, was nevertheless forced to grit his teeth because otherwise he would have been out. So he made the deal. And this is the United States, the Soviet Union, and Great Britain saying that they would not test underwater, in the atmosphere, or in outer space. As at that point, the technology did not allow the powers to distinguish between an earthquake and an underground nuclear test. But as soon as that was refined, then indeed it became a comprehensive nuclear test ban treaty. So August 1963, the limited nuclear test ban treaty by Kennedy. That's the same summer, of course, a couple of months before Kennedy had given his landmark detente speech at the American University graduation, summer 1963. Kennedy was killed in a very short time. This reminds us, Obama, watch your security. This circus, this grand guignol with the Secret Service must stop. Heads must roll. Fire the top three levels of leadership. Get somebody in there you can trust. Watch out for Gulf of Tonkin. Watch out for full slag. And World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Now, the term of comparison is the Lausanne Accords of this past week and the limited nuclear test ban treaty of August 1963. The significance of the Kennedy-backed limited nuclear test ban treaty was that this was a turning point in terms of everything. In other words, we essentially went from a world careening towards confrontation to a world where tensions began to relax slowly but surely, despite various moments where things went into reverse. Even though it's not linear and it's not constant, the overall tendency after that nuclear test ban treaty is towards pulling back from this hair trigger on nuclear war that we had seen in 1962. So the hope would therefore be that the entire U.S.-Iranian, European-Iranian, and world-Iranian relation could be transformed and head towards various kinds of constructive activity. Naturally, the economic possibilities are huge. Another group that is against it are people who want to keep the price of oil high, because if Iran comes back online, the price of oil is going to go down even further, and that would, of course, be beneficial for the world economy, but bad for various oil companies, shall we say, and for those speculators who are long oil with their derivatives. So watch out for that. So once again, check Obama security. Check for Gulf of Tonkin, August 1964 events, military provocations. Watch out for false flag events. Don't believe any of that stuff. Extreme skepticism, extreme vigilance. Now, Look at the reactionary Republicans. They're all against it. Their master, Netanyahu, has spoken, and they all agree, and they hate Obama, and they don't give a damn about the future peace and security and the well-being of the United States. These are scoundrels. They are demagogues and scoundrels. That's my word for the reactionary Republican Party. They are a disgrace. They're a threat to the peace of the world, and they're now thoroughly isolated because they're not just arguing against Obama. They're arguing against the Perm 5 plus 1 plus EU. Again, half the world right there or more, depending on what you're counting. So it's time to get busy. And in particular, people who are considering running for office, this is an issue to run on. Remember that economic development, economic prosperity, and peace go together. If you insert war into that equation, as LBJ found, you can't have guns and butter. You will have guns or butter, therefore you will have guns, therefore no butter, and economic decline. So push hard on this issue. Now with this, it's also interesting, Obama, since he had nothing more to lose politically, has moved to normalize with Cuba, moved to normalize with Iran. Now, Obama, fire Nuland, fire Rice, I would say, and get moving on normalizing with Russia over Ukraine. Why not? These are the Lausanne Accords. I don't want them to become the new Locarno of the 1920s, right, which was an attempt to secure a peace order, but which failed because it was sabotaged. Now, in the Middle East, the fall of Tikrit, this is a turning point. It is a watershed. The myth of ISIS invincibility is gone. The entire Anglo-American Wurlitzer, right, the propaganda apparatus of our dear friends in Wall Street and the City of London, had been attempting to build up over a year or more the idea that ISIS was invincible, that they were supermen with magical powers, sophisticated, formidable. Oh, boy. But now we see it's a bunch of nonsense. The Iraqi army ran away. Why? The Iraqi army has a tradition of being bribed. They were bribed by the U.S. way back in 1991 to run away. They've been bribed by the Saudis. So more recently, just in the past year, it was bribes from the Saudis, from Qatar, from the Emirates and so forth that got those Iranian generals to run away, and therefore the resistance collapsed. You can hear the sour grapes. They don't dare come out and say, boo-hoo, our ISIS asset is being smashed up by the bad Iraqis. They do, of course, complain about the Iranians taking part. And they do, of course, complain about the Shiite militias. But the sour grapes, you can hear it between the lines. And how dare they? They've been telling us ISIS is the end of the world. Chaos, delirium, the collapse of everything. Hell gapes. Well, along comes the Iraq army, some Iranian advisors, and some Shiite militias. And suddenly, the big issue is, oh, will they go on a killing spree and so forth? This is simply a propaganda line. ISIS, I guess we can compare it to Tamerlane in some sources. Timur Lang, right? Timur the Tartar. You know who it is. In the around 1400, or slightly before, this meteoric rise, right? ISIS has had a meteoric rise, just like Timur the Tartar, Tamerlane. But then, as soon as it reaches its maximum extent, it begins to collapse back together. So that, I think, is quite possible, provided that the pounding keeps up. But in the meantime, we've now got the Houthi forces from northern Yemen fighting against the Saudis, right? We're told today that the Saudis have bombed the Russian consulate in Yemen. Bad idea. Bad idea. Don't do it, you Saudis, right? The Saudis are courting disaster, and maybe this is the way that the Saudi regime will pass from the page of history, to coin a phrase, right, that the regime holding Riyadh and Mecca will pass from the page of history. They may. Remember in the bombing of Serbia, 1999, the attack on the Chinese embassy and consulate was a big, big deal. This is another very big deal. And we'll see some reactions. But in the meantime, everybody in the Middle East, except Oman, by certain counts, is now at war. Now, within all this, Charlie Rose has another interesting discussion with Hafez Assad. I would recommend that, Bashar al-Assad. I would recommend to the Syrian government that they put President Assad on television at least once a month, maybe every 2 weeks, to give briefings and to explain the situation. And maybe they can do better than Charlie Rose, but he seems to have accepted the idea that they've got to refrain from the usual editing practices, right? The usual kinds of manipulation of the text. So Assad says, first of all, that he is ready for talks with Kerry. Kerry had made a somewhat ambiguous statement about 10 days to 2 weeks ago, saying we might have negotiations with the Assad government of Syria. Yes, you should do it. So Assad says that he's cautiously optimistic about dialogue. But he says, you have done all these things to us in the meantime. All right, here we go. Assad says, we are always open for talks. We never close our doors. They should be ready for the talk. They should be ready for the negotiation. We did not make an embargo on the United States. We did not attack the U.S. We didn't support terrorists. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Now, we're just going through this very interesting interview with President Assad of Syria by Charlie Rose. And again, he says, we didn't attack you. We didn't support terrorists who were attacking you. The U.S. did these things to us. We have always wanted a good relation with the United States. We have never thought about it any other way. It's a great power. Nobody in his right mind would think of having bad relations with the United States, says Assad. However, you don't dictate our form of government. That's not going to be part of the dialogue, says Assad. It's not your business. We have Syrian citizens who decide this. Nobody else. Whether the U.S. wants to talk about it or not, that is something we will not discuss. And let's see, a couple of other things that he says are quite interesting. Essentially, he says, the West, especially the United States, do not accept partners. They only accept followers. Even Europe is not a partner of the United States. Let me be frank. This is the problem they have with Syria. They want somebody to keep saying yes. They're looking for yes men. And he goes on, the West used to have puppets. In other words, they are accustomed to having puppets, not independent leaders or officials in any other country. That is the problem they have with Putin. They demonize Putin because he can say no, and he wants to be independent because the West and the United States don't accept partners, only followers. That is the issue they have with Syria. So concerning Saudi Arabia, he says, essentially, the Wahhabite ideology of Saudi Arabia is the same identical ideology as ISIS. Exactly. Definitely. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, it's all the same. It all comes from the Wahhabite books. Concerning Turkey, Erdogan, he says, Erdogan is a Muslim Brotherhood fanatic. Someone suffering from political megalomania. He thinks that he's becoming the sultan of the new era of the 21st century. He could, in response to a question, Assad says, yes, he could stop the border. He could close the border between Syria and Turkey. Of course, he ignores the terrorists who who are coming into Syria. He supports them logistically, militarily, every day. What do the Russians want, says Charlie? They want to have balance in the world. The Russians wish to be a great power and have their say about the future of the world. More than justified. So, there we go with that. So the situation is that Kerry, get going. Open talks with Assad and fire anybody who gets in the way. Fire Nuland. Fire Piat. Fire these neocons, right? End all those careers. So we're following this Houthi stuff. It is, of course, not a good thing that Saudi Arabia is attacking a nearby country. We have to point to the fact that the Russian economy is much better than had been thought. All the imperialist commentators last December into January were gloating about the tremendous collapse, the tremendous cataclysm financially and economically that was about to overtake the Russian Federation. And lo and behold, it has not happened. It doesn't seem to make any difference that the price of oil has gone down by half. Russia is managing. And one of the things, it's what we found here in the U.S. under Jefferson's embargo. Well, if you're not trading with foreign countries, you're going to have to manufacture it yourself. So there is now a significant wave of new startups inside Russia producing things for tangible physical production. And it's also the case that the pro-U.S., the CIA, has attempted to overthrow Prime Minister Gruevski of Macedonia a couple of weeks back now, and that also failed. So the machinations of the CIA, not going too well. We are following the coalescence of a group of pro-Russian states in Eastern Europe, and we're looking forward to that situation. Now, Jerry Brown, the governor of California, as we switch to a little bit of domestic economics, Jerry Brown has correctly called attention to the drought in California and to the lack of snow, which had been a reliable source of water in previous decades. Now, he wants to have people stop watering their lawns and everything, and that's all fine. We had that here in Maryland in the mid-90s under Governor Glenn Denning. Right? You were not allowed to use a hose to water any lawn or flower bed. You had to come with a watering can, and that obviously limited it. Right? You couldn't leave your sprinkler on all night. Okay, fine. But, of course, the Imperial Valley, the food production, this has to be maintained. Here's what I would say to Jerry Brown. First thing, Governor Brown, stop fracking. Fracking is a primitive, dead-end technology. This technology is more than 150 years old, I think, in its basics. It goes back to earlier than the U.S. Civil War. What a wretched old technology that is. That's a dead end. And anybody who invests massively in that is going to lose his shirt because it won't hold up. It uses tremendous amounts of water. Stop fracking by executive order, Governor Brown. Now, the second point is, of course, you've got Los Angeles and San Francisco and all these other big cities. You've got to start desalinization. For desalinization, you've got to have nuclear reactors. You've got to have fourth generation, high temperature, pebble bed nuclear reactors. You can have them floated in as duplexes along the coast. You park them and you can get them going. I think the Russians are in a position to market some of these duplexes. Buy a couple of those and you'll get some water going to the people in Los Angeles and the San Francisco Bay Area. You've got to do this. This one, another point where the eco-freak, radical environmentalist ideology, including anti-nuclear, right? It's against coal and it's against nuclear. It's for windmills and solar cells, but that is a bad joke. If you put those together, that is a net loss of energy. over the life of the investment. You got to have some nuclear power. Now, the longer term, which we would like to call attention to, is, of course, the NAWAPA, the North American Water and Power Alliance from the Parsons Engineering Company in the early 1960s. And it essentially looks at the Mackenzie River in northern Canada, huge amount of fresh water that's simply going into the Arctic Ocean and being lost for the needs of human civilization. That river can be reversed, comes down through the Rocky Mountain Trench. There are certain pumping stations and other things. It rehydrates the Canadian prairie provinces all the way over to the Great Lakes, and it rehydrates the U.S. Great Basin and extends far into northern Mexico. It allows for a superb agricultural renaissance in northern Mexico. These are the great works which the future of humanity requires. And now we have NAWAPA, we have Canada, U.S., Mexico, we have NAFTA. We want to have NAWAPA, and we have NAFTA. Well, under NAFTA, it's time to gear that up and treat that as a resource that can indeed be transferred. Interbasin doesn't have to stay in the same basin. Otherwise, you're presiding over the suicide of human civilization and millions of deaths. But you want to see what happens to a country where there's no water? Yemen is such a country. Yemen is such a country. By contrast, Gaddafi's great man-made river means that Libya will thrive as soon as you get rid of the terrorists. Back to the minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. This is once again our Good Friday program that you'll be hearing Easter and during the week thereafter. Now, we want to keep up with the Greek situation. Many strange rumors, a lot of black propaganda, a lot of disinformation flying, especially from our old adversary, Ambrose Evans Pritchard of the London Daily Telegraph, right? The son of, or the grandson maybe, of Sir Edward Evans Pritchard of British intelligence in Kenya. He says that the Greek government is secretly printing drachmas and is going to default very soon, and it's going to default towards the IMF first and then hope to use that to bludgeon the European Union. But again, that's a very unreliable source. So let's get the real story from our good friend Michael Chiotinis in Athens. Michael, welcome.
Hello, Webster. Yes, very unreliable indeed, because I don't think that there's any chance of Greece going to a new national currency, because that would be a catastrophe for Europe, mostly.
Correct. So, where are we now? I guess everybody is reporting that the Syriza government submitted another basis of compromise to the European finance ministers, and they rejected it again. Is that correct?
Yes, it is correct. They are trying to find an agreement. An agreement is still not in sight. I think they will continue once again to push things to the last moment in order to blackmail the Greek government into making concessions. And they are trying to use an economic, a financial asphyxiation as a leverage tool against the Greek government. They know that if banks go, if there's a panic on the bank run, there's a big chance that the Syriza government will just surrender to whatever these Eurocrats want. Now, we have a big, it's on Holy Thursday, the Good Thursday, as you would call it.
That's coming up on the Orthodox calendar. In about 12 days.
Next Thursday, there's a there's a big repayment that Greece needs to do to the IMF. It's in the, to the tune of 450 million euro. Euros. So we have two government ministers were quoted saying that if no loan installment comes until then, an agreement doesn't come and the loan installment doesn't come, then the Greek government will fulfill its obligations towards the Greek people and then ask for a postponement of the money they should repay to the IMF. Specifically, the Minister for Internal Affairs, Mr. Voutsis, was quoting, saying that there needs to be an understanding with our partners and creditors so that the failure to repay the IMF on April 9th isn't interpreted as a credit event. Now, the government spokesman denies that there's any chance of defaulting on the IMF. And my view is that they won't default on the IMF. The government is going to do whatever it takes to repay the IMF because we are talking about the IMF that ironically has been the good cop in the whole story, the bad cop being the European Commission. And also I think that because the IMF is in the sphere of influence of the United States, they don't want to break this kind of mutual understanding with the American side, because they are the Americans, the US has taken the side of Greece in this Greece versus Germany confrontation. So they don't want to do anything to spoil this relationship with the US. And I think that there won't be a default on the IMF. But we need to see, they say money will run out. The Greek government will run out of money in the midst of April. But this may be somewhat of a bluff. The Greek government doesn't allow the technical, the people of the European Commission to check the books. They have thrown them out of the ministries and stuff and these places. So that's the situation. Let me see. There was an interesting article on the Financial Times last week by Nikolaos Blome, who says he's the Der Spiegel Berlin Bureau, the head of Der Spiegel Berlin Bureau, and he says that the title of the article is Greek Morals and German Maths Must Find Common Ground.
I guess that's Greek Morality and German Mathematics.
Yes, exactly. And he tries to say that the Greeks are trying to play the moral card awaken the ghosts of the Nazi past for the Germans in order to take Europe in the side of Greece. And I think they are flirting with this idea. Actually, Germany is very much afraid of having this work rhetorically for Europe.
Let me point out again. Now, I have it from the Kremlin direct that on the 8th of April, Putin will meet with Alexis Tsipras, Prime Minister of Greece. That's Kremlin dated April 2nd, so yesterday.
Yes.
Any speculation in Greece about what that might produce?
The Syriza government is playing the Russian card, but I don't think that they will make this a financial relationship. In other words, I don't think that especially Varoufakis is interested in taking loans from Russia or China. I think he's very much concentrated on finding European solutions for European problems. They want to use this rhetoric. So I don't think there's going to be any financial help from Russia. But there is always issues of cooperation between the two countries, at least on the embargo and this kind of thing.
Okay. There you have the update from Athens, Greece, and we're betting that we're more accurate than Ambrose Evans Pritchard. So thanks to Michael Chiotinas, and we'll see you next week on World Crisis Radio. And we'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Once again, it's the afternoon of Friday, April 3rd. Now, the British general election is moving into high gear. Last night, I believe, we had the debate of the party leaders on ITV. With not just Cameron and Miliband, but Clegg and Farage and the others. But I think we're going to have to point out that none of them knows how to get out of the depression in which Britain now finds itself. So let's go to somebody who does know, and that's our good friend Stuart J. Hooper, who is running for the House of Commons in Essex. And why don't you locate yourself again, because we do have listeners in Britain. Some of them may be in your district and they can vote for you, so please go ahead.
Yes, hi Webster, thanks a lot for having me back on the show.
Absolutely. So,
I am running in South Basildon and East Thurrock. That is the name of the district. It's right down in South Essex, which is just about 50 minutes from central London.
And let me just ask, a dispute has arisen here. Is that the only constituency in Essex, or are there others?
No, that's one of many.
Essex, one of many in Essex,
yeah,
as
Essex
I thought.
Essex is actually the biggest county in the UK. So there are quite a few constituencies here.
Okay. So now how about this debate? Right? The commentators all said that the woman from the Greens got the best result. And I saw her saying that she's against austerity, but I wonder if she's that green, how can she actually deliver?
Yes, her and also the other female leaders from the Welsh and Scottish parties as well, both were well received also. The Greens in particular, as you mentioned, led by Natalie Bennett, they are against austerity and she tries to highlight a need to care for human life. So both of these ideas, very good, very positive things to be promoting for sure. But the Greens obviously also oppose infrastructure and the kind of reindustrialization that could create some positive production as well. So it comes down to them essentially opposing wage and tax austerity, but are almost for what we can call energy austerity. So while you may have some more money in your pocket, the infrastructure situation is not going to get any better. The energy situation isn't going to get any better. It's probably just going to end up actually getting a lot worse as they look to these green technologies that are, for all intents and purposes, completely worthless. Wind power is one in particular that is a complete joke. the cost that it takes to get it up and running is ridiculously high. And then once you do, it's impossible to ever get it at 100% output. So it's a joke.
Absolutely. So again, the Greens are promising a reversal of austerity, but they're really purveying another kind of austerity, right? They want to hit you with energy austerity. So this is a bogus sham.
Yes, and we need to actually look to be providing this infrastructure and this production, and we can do that by taking control of the Bank of England and essentially nationalising it. And after last night's debate, I am quite literally the only person in the entire country standing on a platform that is looking to do this. So in doing so, we can create 0% 100-year credit that we can use to improve our infrastructure, our energy situation, and also look to provide some of this low-cost housing that all the leaders acknowledge is a problem.
Absolutely. The other one that occurs to me is the National Health Service, and that's got to be preserved, of course, but they want to preserve it on a fully funded basis, so you don't have this constant triage. And I guess that would be when the City of London sales tax would kick in, right? So you'd have actual revenue for the government, so you could fulfill your obligations to people in the National Health Service.
Yeah, exactly. So you'd have the constant revenue stream from the 1% financial transaction tax on the City of London's financial institutions. So you'd have the constant revenue from that to be able to fund things like the NHS. And I'm sure once the NHS is boosted up to an incredibly modern standard, we could then look to funnel those funds elsewhere into other sectors of public life, such as education and things like that.
Sure thing. I guess the big disappointment with Clegg was that he ran promising that the fees for the universities would not be increased, and instead they've been, what, doubled, tripled?
Tripled, yes, tripled. And that was after huge protests out in the streets of London in 2011. You've probably seen and heard all about those. So it just comes to show that protests are not listened to anymore. So it's time to do what I'm trying to do and get on the ballot and try to take some power and try and change things from the inside of the system.
Absolutely. And the thing that also strikes me is that all of the commentators are clear that there's not going to be a one-party government. There's going to have to be a coalition. And the coalition could involve this guy Farage. And I guess Farage was also the standout on the, what can we say, the scurrilous side of things with these remarks about people coming to Britain because they have AIDS.
Yeah, that was quite a disturbing comment. I think, in my opinion, that boils down to him basically saying that if anybody does arrive with AIDS, we shouldn't treat them. We should simply put them back on the boat and send them back to wherever they came from. So it's a completely outrageous stance. And the UKIP position is essentially that all of our problems stem back to immigration, which is just completely untrue.
This reminds us of the scapegoating, you know, a minority, scapegoat some kind of a minority and blame them for the depression, right? Didn't we have enough of that in Central Europe in the 1920s and 30s under fascist governments?
Yeah, exactly. So we do not need to be going back to that. The Labour Party, Ed Miliband was obviously there for the latest debate. I hear the music. Are we going to come back?
I'd like to get you back just brief so we can just announce the big news and get your appeal for fundraising, right, as the campaign goes on. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So there we are in the thick of things in Great Britain, in Essex, just a bit east of London, big county, and Stuart Hooper has the answers. How do you get out of a depression without energy austerity and without scapegoating immigrants in the UK Independence Party mode? Stuart, the big news now is that you are close to being on the ballot. Can you bring us up to date?
Yes, so thanks to your listeners and everybody else who has supported me, I will be on the ballot. We've effectively raised the £500 required to pay that fee.
Great. Now, congratulations.
Thank you very much. Now all I need to do is just fill out the paperwork and just do a few things of that nature, and then it will be done, and I will be on the ballot.
Now, so, very briefly, if people, I guess, in Europe or in Britain, you tell me that they can support you now as we get into the actual election campaign. 33 days to the vote, I believe. There's a countdown clock. I've been looking at it. So tell us who can help and how.
I'm looking into this exactly because there are some rules on like the levels of donations, like the monetary amount and then where it can come from, where it can't come from, things of that nature. So for right now, I'd just like to send everybody to my Facebook page, which is Stuart Hooper for Parliament. If you just search for that on Facebook, you'll find it, or go to facebook.com/HOOPERFORMP. Hooper for MP. So if we can build up a little Facebook community there, all the information on further fundraising support will be posted out there.
Okay, wonderful. So you hang in there, and we'll be back next week for a progress report. So congratulations have coming this far, and more power to you, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks a lot, Webster. Looking forward to being back
okay.
with you.
Okay, bye-bye. So we also want to call your attention to the candidacy of Adam Rodriguez, running for county commissioner in Monroe County in Pennsylvania. And that's in the Stroudsburg area, the Delaware Water Gap area, the Poconos area. And I guess we're going to have Adam back next week. But do go and visit the Adam Rodriguez for county commissioner website, and you're also invited to do what you can to finance that campaign. Keeping up with other business, the boycott Whirlpool in favor of Reverend Pinckney. Boycott Whirlpool until Reverend Pinckney is released. You have one opportunity to come out on Saturday, April 4th. That is, as soon as this program is aired for the first time, you'd have to go over to 120 East 14th Street, New York City, PC Richards Appliance Store near Union Square from 1 to 3 approximately. So that's PC Richards near Union Square. The following week, Saturday, April 11th, Kiss Electronics, 230 West 125th Street. And that's also in New York, across from the legendary Apollo Theater, 1 to 3. So if you're out and about in New York City, that is the thing to do. In the meantime, we're also pushing forward on the other fronts, right? You've got all kinds of approaches to this. So, we actually hope to in some of the famous, civil rights, exponents, right? You can think of the obvious ones, and get them interested in this, right? That is the next step, right? Having shown that there is a mass base of support for Reverend Pinckney and what he stands for. Now, a couple of other items. question of NAWPA we've done. How about the so-called religious freedom laws of Indiana and Arkansas? I must say we have a dangerous tendency here. You'll remember the Hobby Lobby decision by the Supreme Court, which seemed to say that if you're a rich oligarch and you employ people, you get to impose, to some degree, your religious beliefs on them. And that, of course, is very, very dangerous stuff. That is the cuius regio, eius religio of the Peace of Augsburg in Germany, right? If you were a feudal lord, any serf on your territory, you could dictate what religion that guy had to protest, to profess. This is too close for comfort. Now, in the case of Indiana, Arkansas, I think the legalities are very simple. In the Anglo-Saxon common law, you have the concept of the common carrier. If you open a ferry, a stagecoach, a train, a bus, an airplane, that's a common carrier. But a hotel is a common carrier. A restaurant is a common carrier. A pizzeria is a common carrier. And once you've opened your doors in that regard, you are not allowed to discriminate among people. You've got to serve all comers, anybody who can pay what you're asking. So that's a common carrier. The other aspect of it is the 14th Amendment. We're going to talk in just a minute. We're living through the 150th anniversary of the last 2 weeks of the main event of the Civil War. Actually, it's going to go on. The Civil War really didn't end in the United States until about 11 weeks, 10 or 11 weeks from now. That is to say, in the future, from the point of view of 150 years ago. But the Union Army, what did they bring? The Union dead, what did they die for? Well, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. The 13th Amendment, slavery is outlawed. You've seen it in the Lincoln movie and many other places, right? Then there's the 14th Amendment, one that the libertarians hate. They hate it because of the anchor babies and other things. They hate it because the 14th Amendment says no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, property without due process of law. And of course, this stuff that the caprice, the purely subjective and really undeterminable religious caprice of a shop owner can allow them to eject anybody. I mean, this has been framed in terms of gay or LGBT. No, this could be anybody. Could be any race, it could be any characteristic whatsoever, purely arbitrary, can't be proved one way or the other, wild subjectivity, not allowed. The 14th Amendment means that you've got to live up to the various federal civil rights laws, and you can't say, I'm not going to serve you because you're part of some group that I object to. Plus, what kind of religious approach says that simply by selling somebody a pizza for a wedding, you're somehow participating in what goes on at the wedding? This is absolutely ridiculous. I must say, Cardinal Dolan of New York, in the interview that's going to be made public in the next couple of days, I think this is a sad, sad performance where he says, well, the people in Indiana are concerned that the rights of these minorities, I guess he says, are being trampled, they're getting too much attention, and the rights of people who want to be religious are not getting enough attention. The Roman Catholic Church, since the Council of Trent in the 1560s, has essentially gotten at this idea that you can enforce religious beliefs by administrative or repressive measures. No, you can't. You can't impose anything by a police state. It will always boomerang. And the idea of trying to manipulate the laws of a country to get certain results, this is very, very short-sighted. So I'm sad to hear the cardinal supporting the demagogue Pence, who is no friend of any religion. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley reporting from Washington, D.C. Now, a couple of notes before we say a few words about Easter and some other anniversaries. The Chuy Garcia campaign in Chicago, I'm afraid, seems so far, and time is virtually run out, the Chuy campaign seems to lack the basic courage to embrace the LaSalle Street tax. Not even a tax, really. It's a fee, a modest fee. $1 or $2 on each end of a trade, and it's really sad that he couldn't pull himself together to do this, and instead started making threats against the unions, or at least seeming to sound that way. So I'm afraid Chuy is a lost opportunity, unless there's some world historical surprise, which we're always happy to get. Happy to be proved wrong, but looks bad in the overall sense. So that's Chuy. What it shows again is that the Democratic Party is structurally incapable of fighting for the people, be it with Rombozo, Emmanuel, or Chuy Garcia. It's going to take something new. It's called the Tax Wall Street Party, with actual class-conscious tax and central bank policies. Now, we want to say a couple of words about Easter. Easter, of course, incomparably the greatest holiday of the Christian year. And the interesting thing is the question of can God come into the world? Well, if the Manichaeans and if the dualists are correct, the material universe is inherently and incorrigibly evil. But Christianity says something different, which I think we ought to welcome, at least to this degree. If God can come into the world, as we mark now with the life of Christ, it means that the world is not evil, or at least it's not necessarily evil. It can be potentially evil, sure, but it's not automatically metaphysically evil. And you see that some of the Gnostics way back when and today, right, Elaine Pagels and her Gnostic Gospels and the Rockefeller Foundation and others, they seem to like the idea that that this coming into the material world was a mistake. And that's the idea of the attempt to rehabilitate Judas, which comes forward at this time of year. In other words, Judas is portrayed by these oligarchs as the guy who understands that Christ has made a terrible mistake by coming into the world, and he helps him to rectify that mistake by sending him back out of the world. But we here reject any attempt to rehabilitate Judas. The idea is monstrous, to put it mildly, because of this philosophical necessity. In other words, we are stuck here in this world, and we can make it better, provided we see the path, right? But if some religion is telling you, no, it's hopeless to make it better, it's necessarily evil, metaphysically evil, then that will paralyze all efforts for positive reforms. And positive reforms is what we're all about. Radical reforms, to be sure, revolutionary reforms from time to time, but reforms that make a civilizational project better. Now, let's just say a couple of words about some of the anniversaries. We're coming into a time dense with anniversaries, some of them glorious, but some of them also very sad. We are in the 150th anniversary right now of the Appomattox campaign of Civil War here in the United States. This campaign goes from March 29th to April 9th, 1865. And it is General Grant, Union forces driving General Lee out of Richmond, and Lee's flight towards such places as Danville or Lynchburg or maybe even the Shenandoah Mountains. But he did not get that far and surrendered to Grant at Appomattox Courthouse April 9th, 1865. And, of course, the surrender of Joe Johnston in North Carolina comes later. The Trans-Mississippi Confederates take a while to surrender. And eventually we get to the Juneteenth, the Juneteenth being when the news of the Emancipation Proclamation finally reaches certain places in Texas and the Trans-Mississippi West. So a glorious anniversary, to be sure, right? Saving the United States, Grant and Lincoln, as two of the Lincoln, especially Lincoln, by all odds, the greatest statesman of the 19th century, and Grant certainly the in contention with Sherman too to be the greatest military figure of the 19th century. Surely much better than von Moltke the Younger at the First Battle of the Marne. But then we have the next anniversary is then the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt, April 12th, 1945, followed then by the Lincoln assassination, the 14th to the 15th of April, 1865. These are very sad anniversaries. These are both world historical tragedies. And then we have the meeting on the Elbe, right? U.S. and Soviet armies meeting in the middle of Germany, the 25th of April, 1945. So these are world historical anniversaries, all of them of the first magnitude. Appomattox, the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt, the assassination of Franklin D. Roosevelt, the assassination of Lincoln, and then this other event, which the current propaganda of the Anglo-American alliance tries to minimize or indeed to completely pass over, the cooperation of the Soviet Union with the Western allies, the United States, helped on by Lend-Lease, to be sure. But the greatest military achievement in human history, the defense of the Soviet Union, and as Frank Knox, the then Secretary of the Navy, said in that Frank Capra movie, Why We Fight, that the United States has an everlasting, eternal gratitude towards the Soviet people for their contributions to this war. So those are the relevant anniversaries. And that's the outlook. The rehabilitation of Judas. I have to, it's just so absurd. I can't keep a straight face with this stuff. But this is what the oligarchical foundation community comes up with, because apparently they do have this Manichaean or otherwise dualist point of view, right? On the one hand, you have spirit, which can be good, but then you have matter, and matter is automatically bad. Well, once again, if you embrace that, you go down a primrose path, which gets very grim very fast, and it rules out the concept of perfecting the creation. It does not allow you to say God advanced the creation to such and such a degree, after which we humans have to carry the ball. We have to perfect the creation beyond what was accomplished in the beginning, if there was, if you accept that way to look at it, or simply to advance the perfection of the universe as a whole, both spirit, culture, faith, and at the same time the material universe. So you can say that Easter amounts to a Hebrew and Greek rejection of the dualism of the Manichaeans and others. And therefore, again, it's a holiday that has something to say to quite a few people. And that's the end of our Good Friday broadcast. We'll see you next week on World Crisis Radio.